Hi, this is Allison Sheridan of the No Silicast podcast, hosted at podfeet.com, a technology geek podcast with an ever so slight Macintosh bias. Today is Sunday, April 13th, 2008, and this is show number 145. Well, guys, I survived 3 entire days without internet access while suffering on a cruise to Mexico. Okay, so here's the deal. I never wanted to go on a typical cruise. All my friends always said, let's go on a cruise, and I didn't want to go on a cruise. And let me put it this way. I don't like being with a lot of people. I don't like overeating. I don't gamble. I don't smoke. I don't like party games, and I don't like loud noises, and I don't like shows, which is pretty much the definition of cruising. Well, I got talked into this because a bunch of parents of our track team kids decided that the kids graduating in 2009 should get a cruise on the summer before their senior year. Well, we decided that was too expensive, so we decided to do it during their spring break. Well, that turned out actually really, really fun because there were 30 of us traveling as one continuous party for like 3 days. We had a great time, but of course I overate, gambled, and went to shows. I think it was fun because we could always go to the pool bar and find a party in progress, and the kids all had fun together and pretty much left us alone. But there was no internet access. Well, they had some, but for unreasonable prices. I didn't even have cell phone service for one of the days. So no email, no chatting online with Bart or avoiding listener James, no Twittering, no reading tweets, no random sampling of fun freeware programs from the web. It was gruesome, I tell you. I survived, but just barely. Well, when we got back, I had a lot of fun with my in-laws. You may recall that about 6 months ago, my father-in-law announced that he was ready to dump Windows and switch over to the Mac. He's an avid reader of the Wall Street Journal, and he reads Walter Mossberg's tech column, which is strange to think about it because my father-in-law is not a tech guy at all. But anyway, he and my mother-in-law have been using the MacBook we bought them back then, and we helped them set up, and they've been loving it. But it turned out they were still using their 8-year-old Dell running Windows 98. He called me a bit ago to announce that he was ready to buy an iMac to replace the Dell completely. So we went off to the Apple store and bought him a shiny new 20-inch iMac. Man, that is one beautiful piece of equipment there. You know, I've played with them in the store from time to time, but it wasn't until we brought it home to the house that I really got a feel for the elegance of that machine. It's just gorgeous. Well, after we bought it, he was up here, and he decided to leave it with me for a couple of weeks so I could start configuring it with all of his stuff. That was like a really mean thing to do because I wanted to keep it. It was like loaning somebody a puppy. Who's going to want to give that back? Well, until it's a dog. But anyway, he wanted some tricky stuff done, which I had trouble really deciding on a perfect solution for. What he wanted was all of his documents to exist on both machines at the same time, on the MacBook and the iMac. Well, that's kind of tricky. I talked a bit to Bart about it way back when we were first discussing this, and syncing software is supposed to be able to do the trick, but you kind of frequently end up with duplicates or you get them out of phase and things like that. Well, when I was on episode 37 of the Mac Roundtable, which, by the way, you should run over and listen to because it was amazing, we started talking about this sort of thing, and I kind of managed to trick him into helping me figure out what to do for my in-laws. Well, David Sparks of MacSparky.com suggested ChronoSync. I downloaded that, and I played with it for just a real short time, but it seemed kind of clunky and geeky enough to me that I think he'd get lost if anything didn't go perfectly with it. I think it might be a good solution for me personally, but remote support of it with so little time for me to learn it and then to explain it to him seemed like a recipe for disaster. I also thought about using .Mac to sync his files, but most of the files he really cares about are financial in nature, so I'm not sure he'd really like having his stuff out in the cloud, and I don't think he'd be wild about spending an extra $100. Well, I finally settled on a solution that's kind of obvious. He bought Leopard for the MacBook, so I just ended up using the sharing function to put a folder on each on the MacBook desktop that points over to the iMac folders where he keeps his data. So the iMac will have to be on, and the MacBook will have to be in the house for this to work, from to be able to get to the files from the MacBook. But it seems like it's a workable solution for him. Maybe not the worst idea to not have his financial files with him when he's traveling around with his MacBook anyway. Well, next is my mother-in-law's photos. And again, thanks to the Mac Roundtable discussion, I learned that iPhoto now has photo sharing. The photos will live on the MacBook, which is going to be my mother-in-law's primary machine. Then, let's say she wants to play on the big machine, all she has to do is turn iPhoto on the MacBook, and then she waltzes over to the next table where the iMac is, and she'll have access to all of her photos. Maybe someday I'll have them set up with some fancy network attached storage and all that kind of thing, but I think for now this is going to be a simple and inexpensive solution for them. As you might also recall, some of the comedy that came from the initial migration of my father-in-law from the Dell to the MacBook came when we had to figure out, how do I get all the files he'd created off of the Dell over the last 8 years? How do I get them over to the Mac? So he has a zip drive on the Dell, which of course is useless. He didn't have USB because it wasn't invented yet, so a thumb drive to move them was out. I suppose I could have spent a week or two trying to figure out how to do network sharing on Windows 98, but that wasn't very appealing. Finally, Steve suggested we just email the files from the Dell over to the MacBook. I scoffed at this suggestion because how long would that take? And some of these files would probably be way too big to fit in an email. Well, Steve kind of took me off into another room so we could speak confidentially, where he explained that my father-in-law had 12 files. I'm not kidding. 12 files in 8 years. That's all he had created or deleted other stuff along the ways. Well, emailing worked just dandy to move the files over. I did get him to buy a small 160-gig external drive. Wish I could remember who made it, but it's really cool looking. It's red and shiny. Looks all neat. And I set up Time Machine on the MacBook so my mother-in-law would be covered. You know how much trouble I've had with Time Machine so far, but I'm willing to give it yet another try. I think I may have figured out, though, while I was working on this, why it doesn't work for me. When I was setting it up for my mother-in-law, I noticed that the backup schedule, that there was a specific backup schedule on it. It does backups daily, and it keeps those for, it does it hourly and keeps those for 24 hours. And then it does daily backups, and it keeps those for a week, and then weeklies until your drive gets full, or something along those lines. Anyway, Steve and I make really big files, him with video and me with audio. Imagine this. He's working on, say, a 50, 30, 40, 50 gig iMovie file. He plays with it for, let's say, 4 hours on a Saturday, which he's known to do. He really enjoys himself. During that time, Time Machine will have made 4 copies of it during those 4 hours, or 200 gigabytes in backups. If he did this for 2 days of the weekend, in less than 2 weeks, he would have completely filled his 500 gig backup drive. So it fails again. Now, it takes a wee bit longer for me to have Time Machine fill up and then fail, but I get there pretty rapidly too with my GarageBand files and AIFFs from my recordings and all that. If anyone has any suggestions, maybe a hack where we can tell it to back up once a day instead of every hour, I would sure love to hear about it. Anyway, when we left our in-laws, they were deliriously happy. We even set them up on iChat so we can do screen sharing with them when they get stuck. My father-in-law is so cute. I got to tell you this one thing that he did. This is so cute. He makes labels for everything. I mean, there's stickers and labels. There's a label on his doorbell that tells you how long to hold the button down. Well, I found the most adorable label in one of his drawers of his desk. It said, and I quote, "Allison, available 7 to 9 p.m. weeknights and all day on weekends." It's basically like he's posted my office hours inside his drawer. I thought that was really cute. I loved it. Well, anyway, on the way home, I had another fun Mac surprise. My sister-in-law, my brother's wife, called to tell me that my niece's PC had just died and she decided to buy an iMac. Now, my sister-in-law is a hardcore Windows person. I got to be on the phone with her while we picked out a refurbed iMac, saving her like $200 through the Apple Store. I told her that she'd better watch out now because now two of her daughters have Macs. It could happen to her. And she said, "I know. I'm really envious when I play on my daughter's MacBook, and I'm jealous when I'm on my brother's Mac. And then I went into the store." We talked a little bit about how tough the story is, but I had an epiphany when she said that. You know about Steve Jobs' reality distortion field, right? That's where when you hear him talk in person, you can't help but just run to the store and buy whatever it is he just talked about because it's clearly the coolest thing ever. You just can't help yourself, right? Well, if you manage to resist because, let's say, your credit card's in your other pants and you actually end up waiting a few hours, you realize that he had convinced you that a displayless chewing gum pack-sized MP3 player would change your life. Well, anyway, my epiphany comes when I realized I think he has reality field distortion transmitters in the Apple Store. Yeah, that makes sense to you, doesn't it? You know how it is. You know, you go in the store and your palms start to sweat. You get a little shortness of breath as you walk by the 30-inch cinema display. I think I'm on to something here, guys. Well, anyway, I had a great weekend spending other people's money at Apple. Paul Burns sent in a great review of Security Spy a couple of weeks ago, so I saved it up for this week when I figured I wouldn't have enough time to create a lot of my own content. I hope you enjoy his review.
Hey, Allison, this is Paul from Memphis, Tennessee. Want to drop you a message. I love the podcast. Keeps me company on the way to work. I want to let you know about a new little software website that I found. It's got a Security Spy. It is a security software for Macintosh users, which is great for me. But also, too, this really is a strong piece of software because if you know Memphis or any other place, you know that Memphis is high in crime. And this piece of software is very handy for me because it basically allows you to set up a Mac. And for me, it's my Mac Mini with an iSight as a server, a video server. You can add multiple cameras throughout your house wirelessly or hardwired. It's a really strong piece of software because for me, I can use it on my iPhone. It gives the interface right there. You can go in and change settings, and you can also have it send out an email to your phone. And if you have a Yahoo email set up, it has IMAP on there, and it is fast. Motion is detected in the house, anywhere within the camera's range. It automatically sends you an email with a photo or two if your choice when setting it up. Also, too, it provides you video security because it will find the spot in the house where you have the movement, and it will immediately start recording. It will record to your hard drive, and if you prefer, it will also upload it to an FTP client of your choice. And it's got an FTP built in, actually, to the Security Spy software. And it sends it to wherever you need it to. And for me, that's great because I can check video on the go on my iPhone if I have an email sent. And also, too, photos. If someone were to come into the house, I've tested it numerous times with my wife coming home just to see if it would help her. And it does. She walks in the house, and I feel more secure knowing that it works because it actually will take a photo and send it to my phone, and I know when she's home. And that's a good thing for me because sometimes I have to work late or she has to work late, and I'm not able to get on the phone and make a phone call. And also, too, you can actually turn it off from your phone, so you do not have to worry about it recording while you're in-house. It's a great little application. And it's over at securityspy.com, and I think the guy who owns the website is called, his name is Ben, and I will have to say that I had my doubts about this piece of software, but after using it for a solid 2 weeks hooked up to my Mac Mini, I'm going to have to say that I really, really enjoy it, and I hope that you're able to use this in some sort of way, if not even on the podcast, for your friends or family or whoever. Anyway, love the podcast. Continue the great work. And I'm sure you hear that all the time, but seriously, it gives me something to listen to on the way to work, and also, too, a little bit different spin than the other podcasts that I listen to. So anyway, we'll see you later. Thanks, Alex.
Gosh, Paul, that was a great review. Well, let me talk to it, but kind of backwards here. I got to tell you, I can never hear often enough that someone loves the podcast. Praise like that will be getting me going for weeks. You know, people are so kind in their remarks. It's really a joy to do this. I just have a great time. You know, I remember one guy once commenting in the forums. He complained about the show. He wrote something, you know, he really didn't like it. So I wrote back and I suggested some other shows I thought he might like better. And he wrote back, "Oh no, I never miss an episode." That was funny. Go figure. Well, anyway, back on topic, this was a great review, and by the way, your audio was fantastic. Sounds like an excellent product you reviewed there. I went out to securityspy.com, and I found out that Security Spy costs $58.80 for a single camera use with options for multiple cameras. Anybody who's interested, go check it out. Well, Honda Bob is my mechanic and my friend. You've heard me regale you with what a wonderful mechanic he is, but this week he decided it would be more fun if he sent in a software review. Yes, Honda Bob is a geek, and proud of it. My tagline is an ever so slight Macintosh bias, so it's good to have Windows software reviews from time to time so I keep up my premise, and since Honda Bob is a Windows user, this will fit the bill perfectly. He's got future plans for more reviews, so this is just the first in a series. Here's this week's review from Honda Bob. The first program I would like to discuss is called InfoSelect 9.0 by MicLog.com. That's MicLog.com. This is the database program that I've been using for about 15 years. I started out with version 3 and have subscribed to upgraded versions whenever they were available. Subscription rates are about $20 a year. It's an information storage program used to store everything from business cards to pictures to calendars and spreadsheets to just about any other information you wish to enter and store. There's even a hot button next to the clock in the lower right. Hit the transport button and the highlighted item is saved to a note in InfoSelect. This makes it very easy to save just about anything. The opening interface is pretty straightforward. It has the usual menu items to navigate the program options. Speaking of options, this program has an extensive option list. Just about any facet of the program is capable of being modified. There are a number of examples that come in handy when trying to input some information that you're not sure quite where it should go. Also included in the program is a calendar function. You can insert things like birthdays and anniversaries, as well as repeating items you wish to keep track of. The database function itself is my favorite. It's very easily created or modified to suit your particular needs. I have three databases right now that I access daily. One is the customer database where I keep all of my customer information, such as address, vehicle description, phone numbers, and even credit card information. Don't worry, it's also encrypted with the DES encryption method. It can be upgraded to PGP encryption by downloading the encryption program at pgp1.com. No one sees my information unless I allow it. I'm in the process of putting all the customer invoices on this database also. I will set it up to add, subtract, multiply, or divide any set of figures. I will use it to total the customer invoice when I work on the car before I print out the maintenance record for that particular vehicle. Another database I use is the paint color database for Honda-powered cars. Each car has a unique paint code for the color of the paint. It's very useful when purchasing touch-up paint or for body shops to get the color just right. I didn't realize that Honda has 50 different shades of red alone. The third database I use is one for trouble codes on Honda and Acura cars. There's about 150 different codes describing problems with cars. This database lets me quickly find the trouble code and what it means. The repair is then a matter of verifying the defect and replacing the defective part. Speaking of finding things, this is by far the fastest search engine I've ever seen. When you bring up a search window, all the items are represented by a red dot. Just by typing characters in the search window, the red dots are eliminated until you find the particular items you're looking for. It'll find any string of characters you type in if it's anywhere in the program. The program also includes an email server, but I'm very satisfied with AOL, so I don't use that feature. Well, thanks, Bob, for sending that in. I had no idea you had such an extensive database experience. And to the listeners here, if you drive a Honda or an Acura, and you wish you had a geek for a mechanic so you'd be able to communicate with him, and you live in the LA or Orange County areas, give Honda Bob a call at 562-531-2321 or shoot him an email over at hdabob@aol.com. Well, it was a great week for reviews, so this is working out good for me, not as much work. Listener Elliot was intrigued enough by the Twitter client Twirl. Try to say that three times fast, Twitter client Twirl. Anyway, he was intrigued enough by Twirl to send in an audio review for us. Let's listen in.
Hi, this is Elliot, and I thought I would make a little audio review of an application I came across the other day called Twirl. So, Twirl, which is actually spelled T-W-H-I-R-L, is a Twitter client for your computer. So it lets you bring Twitter onto your desktop. Now, first of all, let me just explain what Twirl is. Twirl is basically, people describe it as microblogging, but it's a lot more personal. So what you can do is in 140 characters or less, you describe or you answer the simple question of what are you doing? So people like it because you can track your friends and see what they're up to. And it's just kind of a neat way to stay in touch with people. I really like it because I like to watch all my podcasters, such as Allison, and see what they're up to, because podcasters really are role models for me. Along with my parents, obviously, I look up to podcasters and I like to see what they're getting on to or getting on and doing, you know. So anyway, back to Twirl. So I thought I'd list a few of the pros and cons of the app. So first of all, a big pro is that Twirl is 100% free. Now, this was a big turn on for me as I'm in high school. I'm a freshman, and I really don't have that much money to spend on shareware apps such as Twitterific. I mean, Twitterific is only $14.95, but still, that's kind of a lot of money for me to spend. So Twirl is a big turn on for me that it was free. Another cool thing is that Twirl uses what's called Adobe's Air technology, which is a way for web apps to be created for the desktop. So it's this runtime environment, I think, that lets developers use all these different things and make web apps and stuff and put them on the desktop. Now, the cool thing about Air is that it's cross-platform, so it works on Windows and Mac, and thus Twirl works on Windows and Mac. A few of the sort of more internal features that I like about Twirl is that it has a built-in URL shortener. So if you're going to put a URL in your tweet, it'll shorten it down, which is kind of important when you only have 140 characters, because if you had a really long URL, it would kind of suck up the entire post. So that's kind of a neat thing. You can also upload pictures with a service called TwitPic, which is all built into Twirl. I haven't tried that out, but I'm sure it works really good. Also, you can search and filter tweets that come in with a bunch of different options. So if I'm looking for what somebody might have said, I could type in a keyword and it would find all the tweets that kind of match that. Also, you can link multiple Twitter accounts to Twirl. So you could have your maybe business account, your personal account, any different accounts that you manage, you can link to Twirl and use them all on your desktop. There are a few cons that I found in Twirl. First of all, you can't hide it in the menu bar, such as you can do in an app such as Twitterific. So the cool thing is, though, it does fade into the background when you go to another application. So if I, you know, open my email, it'll fade into the background a bit and not be so obvious, which is kind of neat. Also, because it's built on the Air runtime, it doesn't have that native Mac OS X feel. But that's not so much of a con, it's just more of a personal tasting. I like continuity in my in applications I use, but it's definitely readable and definitely usable, and it does look nice and elegant, and you can edit a whole bunch of things such as fonts and font sizes and stuff like that, so you can really make it fit to your needs. Also, you can't change the little noise that it makes when you receive a tweet. I'd like a kind of bird chirping sound, but it gives you this kind of ding sound, you know. So I'd like that to be something that I could change. You can mute it or unmute it, which is kind of useful because you might not want it dinging while you're trying to maybe record a video or, you know, do something that would involve it interfering. So that's kind of cool. So yeah, that's all. I've only been using it for a couple of days, but you can check it out. I can't even talk. You can check it out at twhirl.org. And as I mentioned, it's free. So all you need is the Adobe Air plugin, which is also free. And you can get that through Twirl's website. So that's all for now. You can check me out and follow all my adventures at twitter.com/ElliotMB. That's two L's and two T's. Kind of a cool spelling. That's all for now. I hope you enjoy the rest of your week. Now back to Allison.
Wow, Elliot, this is really fantastic. I really appreciate you taking the time to do this. I like your style of explaining like what Twitter actually is for and why you like it. It's really hard to explain Twitter to people. The way I describe it is it's like doing chat, but not to anyone in particular. People mostly look at me like I have two heads when I say that. And when I tell them that I follow other people, they say I'm just a stalker. Well, there's something oddly compelling about Twittering, and it's very difficult to explain to people who haven't tried it. I got to tell you, Elliot, you have a terrific voice and a great ability to explain things. I learned one really interesting thing from your review. I did not know that you could search in Twirl. I've been using it for a while, and I never noticed that. And I'm very honored to be considered a role model for you. I'll try to live up to your expectations. By the way, there is some confusion on whether Twitterific costs $14.95 or not. The website definitely says that you can buy it for $14.95, but people also told me it was free. So I wrote to the developers and they explained that their e-commerce software doesn't have the flexibility to explain that it's $14.95 without ads, but free with ads. It makes them imply that it costs money, but if you do want to use it without paying, you get ads. I thought that was a good trade-off. After listening to your review, I started following you on Twitter. Thanks again, and anytime you want to do another review, I'd be glad to have it. Well, it's time for another exciting episode of Chit Chat Across the Pond with Bart Bouchatz of bartbouchatz.ie. How are you doing today, Bart?
Could be doing better, to be honest. I seem to be getting my first major relapse from my chest infection from earlier in the year.
I'm telling you, I really think you ought to come to California and just bake in the sun for a week.
Certainly sounds tempting. Pity about the practicalities.
That is unfortunate. Well, let's see. I want to promise the audience that this is the last episode of This Week in HDR, but we have more to talk about this high dynamic range photography, because Frank Jonan wrote in and challenged Bart's move to compress the TIFF images that he had created with his what's the program called?
Bracketeer
that he created with Bracketeer. He created a TIFF image and then he compressed it down to a JPEG and then he went over to iPhoto and did the processing there. And Frank suggested that was a really bad move and that he ought to never do that. So Bart and Frank and I kind of got into some interesting discussions, and Bart, being an experimental physicist, had to run some experiments. So I thought we'd just spend a couple of minutes chatting about that.
Yeah, well, I sort of figured that, yeah, okay, we're losing some data by going to JPEG because JPEG can hold less than TIFF can. But I didn't think we were losing too much because of the fact that I was able to get so much out of my HDR images regardless. So I figured I'd take the one set of images, I think it was six images, do the bracketeer thing, and then take the TIFF, convert it to a JPEG 2000, leave it as a TIFF, and also take the best of the original images and import those four files into iPhoto and process them. So, if it's true that by converting to JPEG I completely undid all of the work Bracketeer did, I shouldn't be able to see a difference between the one I converted to a JPEG and the best of the originals. But of course, there's a dramatic difference. So there's a very dramatic difference. It's definitely a big improvement. So I knew I was definitely not utterly destroying everything by going to JPEG, and I was saving about five times the space, which is good.
Well, because those TIFF images are just gigantic, right? How big is
23
this?
Megs a pop, oh. Yeah.
Sitting on a laptop, sure that's a gigantic space. Number for me.
And for me. My poor little MacBook Pro is really suffering. So then the next step was to see what I could do with the TIFF. So I brought in the TIFF, and I was able to get basically exact the same result, except that with the TIFF, there was a lot less processing needed to get that same result. So with the JPEG, I was really pushing it, having to push the shadows right up and so forth. Whereas with the TIFF, it was only a small tweak of all the sliders that was needed. So quite clearly, the TIFF had more information and it was a better format.
Okay.
But it's bloody big. And so if you have infinite hard disk space, or enough of it anyway, then certainly the TIFF is the way to go. But I figured, you know, I had a hunch that JPEG 2000 was a big improvement on JPEG. So that's why I also did the JPEG 2000. And it is identical in terms of processing it. So I put all the sliders in the identical place that I did with the TIFF on the JPEG 2000, and I could not see any difference in the result. So for all intents and purposes, it's identical.
So, I mean, even if mathematically perhaps the TIFF is better, if you can't see it, that doesn't matter, right?
That's the way I look at it anyway. I'm a bit of a pragmatist about these things. Now, the JPEG 2000, I was saving the JPEG 2000 lossless, which I suppose is probably important. So you're definitely not losing anything to compression there. And I suppose the other thing to note is that it's a little bigger than a regular JPEG. They were coming in at about 6 megs. But I'll settle for 6 megs over 23.
Definitely. What program are you using to create the JPEG 2000?
Preview.
So you're opening. So a bracketeer creates the TIFF. You open the TIFF in Preview, save it out as a JPEG 2000, and then delete the TIFF.
Exactly, okay. And then suck it all into iPhoto.
Now I had never heard of JPEG 2000. Where'd that come from?
It's just an update to the JPEG standard. It's just a more modern JPEG.
Has it been around for a long time?
I would imagine since around about the turn of the century. Just purely going on a guess there, why else would they call it JPEG 2000?
Oh, I don't know. Windows 98 didn't come out in 1998, did it?
Yeah, but roundabout, like. for all intents and purposes. The other thing is, the JPEG 2000, when iPhoto sucks it in, it uses the file extension JP2.
Oh, okay.
Which to me was always a Pope rather than a graphics pro thingy, but anyway.
So the JPEG 2000 looks as good as the TIFF, and so if you were to do it today, are you going to do JPEG 2000 or JPEG or TIFF?
From now on, I'm doing JPEG 2000s.
Okay, so it was definitely worth Frank poking this turkey and asking some questions, I think. You know, his response about having to keep all this information reminds me of when I was scanning in my family photos. I was going through, it was quite a learning process to figure out what kind of resolution you should do it at. At first, I was scanning in all these black and white photos as color, and I figured out that was taking way too long. And after about 300 of them, I figured that out. But I called two of my brothers. I called my brother Jan and asked him what he thought about what resolution I should scan at. And he said, well, you should scan it at the absolute highest resolution you possibly can, because technology is only going to get better and you don't want to ever lose any of that information. Well, I did a test, and a 1200 DPI image versus a 300 DPI image was like six times as long. And it was going to take me the rest of my life if I'd done that. I called my other brother.
Yeah,
my brother
mentioned storage.
Oh, yeah. It was insane. These files were just gigantic. And you know, they are snapshots from the 1950s. So, you know.
Yeah.
So I called my brother Kelly and asked him the same question. He said, geez, Allison, we're not the Beatles. I think you can just go with the low res.
Well, and if you could figure out the size of the grain on the photograph, that'll tell you how much to scan it.
I guess. But, you know, no one's ever printed any of the photos that I scanned. We scanned them all in. We look at them on a computer at 72 DPI anyway. But again,
yeah, exactly.
It gets down to what can you see? You know, can you really see the difference? Are any of these photos, you know, if there was something that was like the epic family photo that was, you know, our greatest memory of all time, we wanted to blow up to, you know, 16 by 20 on our walls, maybe I should go higher. But I did them all at 300 and I was happy. I actually got the project done. So that was what was important.
Yeah, I'm currently scanning in my old photographs, and I'm scanning them in at 300 as well, and it's more than good enough as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, yeah. I like I said, I do recommend doing it in black and white instead of, or grayscale instead of color. And also, I figured out you could put a whole bunch of them on the bed at the same time, and since the scanning process is actually the longest, that was attractive.
Yeah, that's what I do as well, and the Epson software is actually very good at spotting which are the two separate images, and it'll create two files for them.
Oh, that's really nice. No, I had to take them all into Photoshop and cut them out one by one, crop them.
No, the Epson stuff is quite smart. It senses where stuff is, and automatically does all that cropping and stuff for you, and it's exceptionally reliable. I haven't had any problem at all.
Wow. I had a childbirthing episode with an Epson printer about 10 years ago, and I swore myself off Epson for the rest of my life.
Actually, see, it'll even straighten the images, which I think is very impressive.
That's really nice. I don't know. Yeah, someday,
you know,
I may have to forgive them.
Perfectly straight in the bed.
Oh, yeah. No, yeah. No. I spent a lot of time straightening, that's for sure. Now, I bought an Epson printer. I can't even remember the model number now, but it was just awful. It was the worst thing about printers. It had nine buttons on the front, and the ninth button was one that doubled the functions of all the other eight buttons. So there were 16 separate controls on the front face. About maybe twice a week, it required realignment of the print cartridges, which used ink. It made me do that. Yeah. And after, it was a little over a year old in a 3-year warranty, and it died on me. And it took me 4 hours on hold to get Epson to honor the warranty.
Good God.
I was in tears at the end of the 4 hours. When I finally got it done, I was going to get that dang thing sent in no matter what. So I took it and I packed it up in a box and I shipped it off to them, and I drove to the store and bought an HP 950. That was 10 years ago. That HP 950 is sitting on my desk right now. I think it was 10 years, eight maybe. It's sitting on my desk right now, printing happily away, and it has three buttons. It has power, push the paper out because I didn't really want to do that, and cancel. Three buttons.
Yeah, well, actually, my printer has two.
Oh, that's way better.
One to turn it on and one for everything else.
I really like
one
simple.
Of them. Yeah, it's a giant big green button and a little orange button that if it gets grumpy about something, you do whatever it asks, and you hit that button and it says, okay, go on.
Yeah, yeah, that's definitely the way to go. Well, let's see. What else do we want to talk about here today? You had some more interesting thoughts on RDP. You want to back us up and tell us what you're talking about here?
Well, I'm not sure they were interesting thoughts, but I had a comment on Twitter just asking for a quick demo of how you go about setting it up on the Windows end, because it's all good and well grabbing the client, but unless the Windows machine is actually, you know, serving out RDP, it's not much good to you.
Oh, explain what RDP is again for folks.
Remote desktop protocol. So basically like the screen sharing stuff that you're now used to in Leopard, only sharing with a Windows machine instead.
So you're connecting into a Windows machine and displaying its window back to your Mac?
Yeah, and it also has a couple of other nice features, like you can copy and paste between the two, which is dead handy.
Huh.
So actually, it's for a Windows thing, it's surprisingly easy, but in a strangely typically Windowsy way, not in the place you'd expect, which I think is sort of the way with Windows. So it's the way you get to it is you go into your control panel, you go into the system applet thingy, which certainly isn't where I would have started looking, and then you go over to remote, and then there's one single checkbox you click, and away you go.
Oh, nice. Now, do you have to have administrator privileges on the Windows machine to do that and all that, right?
Oh, yeah, definitely. If you run the Windows firewall, it'll automatically allow it through. Whereas if you run a third-party firewall, you're going to have to do a bit of jiggery-pokery there.
Now, have you ever used stuff like, isn't it Synergy is the one that allows you to do remote desktop between Macs and Windows?
That's not the same thing. I have played with Synergy, although I was doing it between Mac and Linux, shockingly. But Synergy is different, though, because it's sharing your keyboard and mouse, whereas each machine stays on its own screen. RDP is taking the screen into a window on your screen.
Oh, okay.
So they're not really comparable. One, Synergy is sort of a software-based KVM more than anything else.
Right. That's where you have a lot more control of that machine, too, I think.
Well, it's not so much you have more control. Literally, it just connects your keyboard and mouse to that other machine, but you still have to use its monitor. So you're actually other machine.
Okay, so it's almost backwards of the same thing.
Yeah, I suppose it is, actually, yeah.
I'm glad I've clarified this for everyone.
Yeah, it's no harm. No, Synergy is nice. Synergy is a cool product. If you have lots of machines on your desk at once and you don't want to have lots of keyboards, just throw all the keyboards away except for one and use Synergy to share that one keyboard between the lot. And it works cross-platform fantastically. And there's also a Mac-only version that does exactly the same thing, but more shiny, as is the way with Macs, and that's called Teleport.
Oh, okay. Well, now, back on Synergy, one of the problems I had with Synergy was I tested it on a Mac and Windows in my house when I had a Windows box, and the Windows installation was this beautiful, shiny, double-click installation interface, little pretty GUI, and on the Mac, I had to go into the command line and do it with a hacksaw. It was really awful. I don't know if somebody's got a nice client for that yet.
There, when I was still using RDP, I did manage to find a preference pane for, or not RDP, sorry, Synergy. I did find a preference pane for it for the Mac. Okay. And that made it much less painless. But Teleport makes it completely and utterly painless, and it'll even encrypt the traffic and stuff for you. It's fantastic.
Now that's Mac to Mac, right?
So once you fire it up, it's Mac to Mac only, but it does use Synergy's actual libraries underneath. But it'll actually give you a little display. So it shows you all the shared machines in the top, and you drag and drop them to arrange them.
Oh, wow. I need to go play with that.
Yeah, absolutely. I use it all the time because I have my good ergonomic keyboard and my nice ergonomic mouse on my Mac Mini, and I don't like using the keyboard on the MacBook Pro if I'm writing something long. So I just always have Teleport running and just beam in and beam out as appropriate.
Great. Well, so back on, you were setting up RDP to get to a Windows machine. I think it was our friend from Indie Radio Chat that gave the request to you, and you wrote that all up on your blog of how to set it up, right?
Yeah, absolutely. And it's actually a very short blog post, as it turns out, because it really is as simple as opening up that preference pane, taking that one checkbox, and you're done.
Great. All right. So the last thing we wanted to talk about was GIMP for Leopard, the easy way.
Yeah, that was there was very little cosmic trouble when I moved to Leopard. Almost nothing, really. But one thing that did was the GIMP, in that the actual regular GIMP packages would crash. And it's something to do with the fact that they changed X11, apparently for the better. But the change nonetheless broke the GIMP, and probably a few other apps as well that I just don't use. So for a long time, I couldn't get the GIMP to run on Leopard at all, which was really annoying. And then a few months after Leopard came out, I managed to get it working, but only sort of what I would consider to be the hard way, which is using Mac ports. So basically down to the command line and compile the damn thing from source, which is unpleasant. Now, using Mac ports, it's issue one command, and it'll automatically download and build it from source. But that doesn't change the fact that it's downloading and building from source. So it takes 3 or 4 hours to get your... well, maybe not quite that long, but it takes a very significant amount of time to get your GIMP up and running.
Oh, my gosh.
So I needed the GIMP for something in work, and I hadn't done that process on my work Mac because I don't need the GIMP in work very often. I mean, Linux sysadmins don't really spend much time editing pictures. But I needed it for something, and... Well, actually, no, it's because I had a camera with me, and we have a new deputy director, and his picture had to go into the newsletter, and they wanted someone to take a nice picture of him, and they just came straight down to me and went, Bart, take a picture. So I did, but he was in a room where there was both natural light and artificial light, so the white balance went a bit, ugh. So I needed to just tweak the white balance a bit. So I figured, I know I'll install the GIMP. Although, as it happens, I didn't use the GIMP in the end, because it was... I don't know why, actually. I think it was my ADD kicked in or something. And while it was downloading, I decided to open it up in preview and see what preview had, you know, because I know preview improved with Leopard. And preview actually has almost all the sliders iPhoto has.
Really? I have never
used
that.
Yeah, I was shocked. Including a temperature slider. So I was like, oh, there we go. White balance done. Finished.
You're kidding. I got to go play with preview.
It was I think it's tools colors or something, and then the same little transparent thingy pops up that you're used to seeing. It's not exactly the same as an iPhoto, but it has pretty much all the same sliders as far as I can see.
Wow.
It doesn't have the histogram, but it's still, I was most impressed. It's a big step forward from the old preview that app.
Wow. Oh, look at this. There are tons of things in here. Adjust color, adjust size, rotate left, right, flip, markup, all kinds of stuff.
Yeah, it's become sort of more of an image editor. excuse me. And the other, I did notice one small bug with it, though. If you have an image which has been rotated using its EXIF data, it will open it correctly the first time. So it'll be in portrait instead of landscape. You make your changes, you hit save, and then it seems to lose that EXIF tag. So the next time you open it, it's sideways.
So it's not quite
so
perfect,
then you straighten it, save again, and then all is good and stays good.
Okay. This is
But it seems that
this sorry, is the best thing you I'm sorry, this is the best thing you've told me about on the show for quite a while here. I think this I mean I'm looking at sliders for exposure, brightness, contrast, saturation, temperature, tint, sepia black level, white level, and sharpness. What do I need Photoshop Elements for?
Yeah, you have to wonder. And the other thing that's while we're on the topic of preview that app becoming cool. I don't know if you remember ages and ages and ages ago when I was still emailing you in contributions every now and then. It may have been one of the very first things I ever emailed you about was a little tool to allow you to assemble a PDF by taking pages from different places and rearranging them.
Yeah, I remember that.
Yeah, you can do that in preview now.
Oh, wow.
So open up a PDF, open the little drawer, and you can drag and drop from one document into another, drag and drop to rearrange them, and you're done.
Oh, that's fantastic. This is a really capable little tool.
It's sort of, no one thinks of it when they say, oh, Leopard, you know, what does Leopard give us? It gives us spaces and all this other stuff. But actually, I think little preview that app is probably very much underappreciated.
Oh, definitely. You know, this is one of the things I think that we take for granted on the Mac side, but I noticed as soon as I started using Windows for the first time was that there's all these little tiny things that you just take for granted will exist, and you go into Windows and they're just not there. I remember I tried to burn an ISO preview image and I couldn't do it. You had to go get an application to do it. And, you know, okay, maybe it was only $5 or $6 for a little application to do it, but I just felt like I was death by a thousand paper cuts, you know?
Well, it's not so much the money, it's more the effort.
Yeah, well, it was the money in my case. I was like, come on, I can't burn an ISO image for free. I got to go buy something. I after about 3 weeks of searching, I found a free one. But, you know, come on.
Yeah, well, things have improved in that regard because there was a time when you had to go buy an unzip program for Windows as well.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no, that 7-Zip is doing the trick for me there. But you know what else? I just played with while we're talking, you know, because my ADD kicked in, and I had on this cruise we were on, they had all these every night they would fold our towels into a different animal, and I had a picture of a little rabbit or something like that, and it was very yellow looking, and I had brought it into Photoshop Elements, and I'd done slide, I'd done all these, you know, color, temperature, blah 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 blah. I just couldn't get it the way I wanted it. I just did it in 5 seconds in Preview, worked perfectly.
Yeah, it would have been the same in iPhoto.
Ah, well, you know how I feel about iPhoto.
I know, and you know how I feel about iPhoto. Anyway, I think we were supposed to be talking about GIMP the easy way.
Okay, sorry. So GIMP is, by the way,
we gave the answer. We just explained the problem, and then we wandered off.
Right, right. Well, we did. We should say, I'm not sure we said it at the beginning, that GIMP is a photo editing tool that's an image editor, I should say, that's probably pretty close to equivalent to a Photoshop or Photoshop Elements, but it's open source, freeware, the whole thing.
Yeah, I'd put it above Elements and below Photoshop.
Yeah, probably. Because I think it has curves, doesn't it?
Oh, it does curves and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, it does way more stuff than I know how to make go.
Yeah,
way more.
Elements doesn't, so.
Oh, Elements doesn't do that kind of stuff.
No, it doesn't do curves. That's one thing it very definitely doesn't do.
So, no, yeah, the GIMP does all that fancy stuff.
So where did you find the good GIMP for Leopard now?
It has to be one of the most sort of strange sounding names for a project I've ever come across. The project is called Wilbur Loves Apple.
Who's Wilbur?
I have no idea, but I like Wilbur because he's done a good job of packaging the GIMP. So if you go to, now the webpage for Wilbur Loves Apple isn't wilburlovesapple.com or anything like that. It's darwingimp.sourceforge.net.
Okay.
And if you go there and you go to download, you can download a DMG file, double click it, drag and drop, and you're done.
Oh, I'm going to do that. If nothing else, it's a really pretty webpage.
It's a very pretty web page, and his little GIMP icon is cuter than the other traditional GIMP icon.
And you know we're a sucker for a cute icon, right?
it's something we both have indeed. It's like, if it's cute, yeah, okay, I'll get that.
I think we talked about that with CyberDuck, right? We both like the ducky.
Yeah, the ducky's cool.
Very nice. Well, we thought we didn't have too much to talk about it, but it looks like we've managed to blather on for a long time again.
Yeah, someday we're going to, you know, cut right down to our 15 minutes on the dot, but how are we doing today?
21:41 so far.
Jesus, okay. I thought we were going to come in low. Anyway, there we go.
All right. Well, Bart, thanks for joining me again this week. Like I told you before we got on the air, I'm getting a lot of great feedback. People like your grumpy comments, and they really enjoy you on the show.
I'm not always grumpy, but it does happen.
Grumpy Muppets, the whole thing.
Exactly.
All right, Bart. Well, till next time, I'll probably talk to you next week.
I sure hope so. And until then, happy computing.
Wow, I guess that better be enough for this week. I didn't think I would have enough content, and I'm up at 47 minutes already. Oh, no. Well, I even moved 3 articles to next week. So anyway, well, hey, thanks for all your kind wishes about our vacation. It helped me survive living in meat space for 3 days without all of you. Last week, I actually used Ustream.tv to broadcast video live as I created the show. Don't know if you knew about that. I did it kind of spur of the moment. I just Twittered about it right before I started, and a whole bunch of people came on to watch and chat live with me while I worked. It was really fun, and I got some requests to do it again this week, but I was all icky and sweaty because it was like over 90 degrees in LA this week, and I'd power washed the driveway and washed a car, and it wasn't a pretty sight. So I decided not to do it. But I think I'm going to start doing it again. If you're doing nothing at around 5 p.m. Pacific Standard Time on Sunday nights, go over to Ustream.tv and look up NoSillaCast, and I might just be broadcasting. Another way to find out, though, is I'll also Twitter about it right before I go live. You can follow me on Twitter as Podfeet. Just go over to twitter.com/podfeet and click on the follow button. Well, please keep sending on all your great emails with questions, suggestions, and comments. Even tell me when I'm wrong. It's a great way for me to learn. Send those emails to Allison@podfeet.com. Thanks for listening, and stay subscribed.